Merchavim, merchavim, merchavei el ifta nafshi. Expanses, expanses, expanses divine my soul craves, writes Rav Kook in one of his most intriguing and virtually unknown poems. Today, we will continue our discussion, long interrupted but finally returned to, on Rav Kook's poetry, which we began a number of weeks ago by asking, why did Rav Kook write poetry in the first place? What can poetry convey that prose cannot? And what can poetry offer the religious life? What can poetry offer the religious life for the poet? And perhaps what can it offer to the consumer, the reader, the one who appreciates poetry? As always, this is Jeffrey Sachs from Atid, sitting with Rabbi Chaim Bravender and Rabbi Yedidia Sinclair, and we will be looking at one, maybe two, as time allows, of Rav Kook's poems. This poem, Merchavim, Merchavim, has an interesting story, and we actually owe something to Rabbi Sinclair for ferreting it out for us. I now turn the floor and the microphone to Rabbi Sinclair.
Thank you, Rabbi Sachs. So when we last spoke, we were talking about why Rav Kook wrote poetry. And we said that, you know, that poetry enabled him to express the most personal side of his spiritual life in a way which prose couldn't. We have about 40 or 50 of Rav Kook's poems published, and there may well be more. A collection of about 20 came out first of all in the journal Sinai in 1945, edited by a scholar, Aleph Mem Haberman. But others have trickled out since, and in fact just in the last few months, another collection of Rav Kook's manuscripts has come out, little notebooks which hadn't previously been printed. It was one called Pinkas HaRishon Shel Yafo, one called Rishumot London, one called Pinkas Tafresh Tzadik Gimel, 1933. And these also have quite a few poems in, including poems which I personally wasn't aware of before. So there may well be more than we knew. But what we do know is that Rav Kook wrote poetry throughout his life. The first poetry we know of that he wrote was in 1882, when he was 17. That's published in the volume which contains Orot HaTorah. And in his notebook in 1933, when he was 68, a couple of years before he died, there's more poems. So it's something he felt an urge to do throughout his whole adult life. Well, Kook's poetry is interesting in the way it adopts the styles of Hebrew poetry which were current at the time. The poem I first mentioned in 1882 is an epic poem about the Maccabees, which goes on for pages and pages, and about their heroism and telling the story, and it seems to be, not that I know a great deal about Hebrew poetry, but it seems to be very much in the style of Yehuda Leib Gordon, who was the leading Hebrew poet of the 19th century, who wrote these epic narrative poems based on biblical themes. Rav Kook's later poems seem to be very much influenced by Bialik. Bialik famously wrought a revolution in Hebrew poetry, in which he made the language much more dense and much more personal and colloquial, while at the same time weaving in traditional Jewish makorot. And it seems that Rav Kook is very much influenced by that. His poems are also very personal, obviously lots of makorot, psukim, midrashim, etc. And it seems that later in his life he was influenced by that too. Unless you say the other way, but Bialik was influenced by Rav Kook, which seems unlikely. Bialik himself thought a great deal of Ralph Cook's poetry. He writes that Ralph Cook was, of course, a great spiritual figure, but he writes that if our generation had merited it, he might have had attained the keter of Shira as well as the keter of Kedusha. Whatever exactly that means. But he's saying perhaps he had the potential to be a great poet, but you know, he had to choose, and so he became a great great rabbi and teacher. But his poetry, in my opinion, is very mixed. I mean, virtually everything that, you know, it hasn't been edited at all, and so that some poems are, you know, frankly a little bit lame, but some of them are, in my humble judgment, very good. So we can see what Bialik was talking about. The first poem we're going to look at, as Rabbi Sachs said, is called Merchavim, Merchavim. And it's not entirely true to say that it's virtually unknown. But interestingly, it's hardly been reproduced in Hebrew since that initial collection by Haberman, which I referred to. There have been a few collections of Ralph Cook's poems since, but they don't include this one, as far as I know. However, the English translation was translated into English in Ben Sion Boxer's anthology in the Classics in Western Spirituality series. And so you actually, from time to time, find it quoted in English sources, English books and articles about Ralph Cook. But it hasn't, to the best of my knowledge, been reprinted in Hebrew. And we'll see why that might be. It seems to contain some outrageous sentiments, although actually I think that they're not nearly as outrageous as they might seem on first reading. Do we have any questions or comments before we go on and carry on? Okay.
Did Ralph Cook ever say anything about poetry? I mean, besides writing poems?
He writes about Shura. And then the poems that the passages which we looked at last time, he talks about how he feels compelled to express himself in Shura and why, and in abstract blank verse, because that's, with a minimum of constraints and restrictions, because that's the best way for him to express his soul. And there's a famous passage, also known in English as the fourfold song, Hashem Shira Hamuruba, I think, where he talks about how all existence is singing a song, and there's a song of the individual, the song of the Jewish people, the song of all humanity, the song of the cosmos. So, yeah, he does. I can't say anything systematic about what he says about song, but he does certainly talk about it. So in this passage, in this poem, he picks out the theme which we left off last time, of how he finds it very hard to say what's on his mind in traditional forms of expression. And one thing to keep in mind is, does he say it any better in poetry than he said it in prose in the passage we looked at last time? I'm not sure myself, but see what we think. So with all due allowance to my limitations as a in the field of Hebrew poetry, let's try and make sense of this poem. So, Merchavim, Merchavim, Merchavei El Ivtar Nafshi. Al tiskuruni b'shum klub, lo gashmi v'lo ruchani. Shatahi nishmati b'rechavei shamayim, lo yachilu kirot leib. So expansive, expansive divine my soul craves, confine me not in cages of substance or spirit, it translates it here. My soul sails in the expanses of heaven. It can't be walls of heart and walls of deeds can't contain it. Morality, logic, custom, my soul soars above all these, above all that bears a name. So, you know, Ralph Cook is seems to be expressing his thirst, his yearning for a kind of a religious experience which goes upon or beyond limitations that any forms or concepts could place upon it. Musa higayon v'nimus. Me'al l'chol asher yikare v'chol shem imarom v'chol ane. Above anything that can be called by any name, above all delight. You know, and here he's saying that what he's striving for is beyond even what can be expressed or named in words. Something he says in other places when he's talking about theology and attempts to speak about God, he says that actually any attempt to give God a name inevitably falsifies what you're talking about, because any name is a referent and can't refer to God in any way, because what you're trying to speak about inevitably goes beyond what any word can encompass. So he's very much aware of the limits of language to express and carry what he's yearning for. Again, he goes on. Mikol noam v'yofi mimarom l'chol nisgavneh tzar cholot ahava ani tzameti tzameti l'elohai ka'ayal al ha'afikim. So, you know, there a quote from the Tehillim Mem Gimel, I think, that I'm thirsting for God like a deer thirsts for water brooks. You know, you see throughout Ralph Cook's poetry, you know, the use of you know, traditional Jewish sources and poems as well. And I found a reference to in one of his poems to a poem by Yehuda Halevi, where he says, "I'm an Eved of Hashem. I'm not an Eved la'Avadim." And I think Yehuda Halevi has a poem where he says, Av deis man av dea avadim hem evet Hashem la'olam chofshi. He also, Yehuda Levi also talks about, you know, being a slave of slaves, and Cook says he's not that. In clear reference to Yehuda Halevi's poetry. So he's inheriting with and experimenting with, you know, forms of Jewish poetry throughout the ages. He goes on, Hoy, mi yamalel ke'evi, mi yihye kino k'shire yigoni, mi yashmiya kol murirati. Who will, they're very, very pained language. Now, hoy, ovei, who can express my pain? Who will be a violin for the song of my groaning? Who can make heard the voice of my bitterness? What's the bitterness about? It's about, I think, this impossibility of expressing what he's feeling, what he's experiencing. Sa'ar b'tui ha'rachav me'achavei kol yamim tzameti le'emet lo la'hasagat emet. A poignant phrase. I want the truth, and not conceptions of truth, ideas of truth, but there's some sort of real, immediate experience of the truth. Used to be what he's demanding. Hare ani rochei v'aschakav, hare ni kuli v'toch ha'met muvlam, hare ani kulo mochav mitzah v'tui, eich ze'evater emet ha'gadola, ha'malea et kol levavi. How can I express this great truth which is filling my heart? Mi yegale l'rabim l'olalmim l'bu'im l'meloh kol l'goy v'adam v'yachad et hazikim male otsrot or v'chom z'heim atzorim v'nishmati p'nimi. Again, he seems to be insisting on this theme over and over, that how can I express the greatness of what I'm feeling and what I'm experiencing in my heart. There's just no way to put it into words, even though he's resorted to the medium of poetry to try and express it. Any thoughts on what we've read so far before we carry on?
You know, when you read poetry,
yeah,
you know, certain things echo, certain things, you know, phrases bounce around your head.
Mm-hmm.
So I had an association with the end of Rambam's Hilchos Tshuva, with the 10th parak in Hilchos Tshuva, here on Cholat Ahava and Truth.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, where the Rambam discusses, you know, Oseha Emet Mipnei Shehi Emet.
Yes.
Ki Cholat Ahava V'hush Shlomo Amadech Mashal Ki Cholat Ahava Ni etc. In other words, I'm not sure, you know, we'd have to look, I just, you know, now Toch De Kriya pulled the Rambam off the shelf, we'd have to look carefully to see, is he trying to play off something or not, but that's an association that rang for me as we're reading through it.
Very nice. I hadn't thought of that, but it's very likely that well, Cook had that in mind,
not necessarily.
I don't think you could ever.
Those are the two. You know, let's say the two key words in that monumental concluding chapter of Sefer Mazah. So.
Yeah. I think it's very likely, and yes. I mean, you could never prove it because, well, Cook doesn't have footnotes, but but yeah, that juxtaposition of Chol Ahava and Hemet is very. It's very distinctive, as you say, to that that chapter. So it goes on, and now this is the bit which, now if there's a reason why this poem hasn't appeared very much since 1945 in Hebrew, I think it could be this following passage. He says, "Va'ani eni gibor el ke'echad agiborim asher melo olamim." Matsuba Tokam Penima. And as me, I'm not like one of those heroes. How would one describe Gibor Suosei Giborei El? Is it spiritual heroes? Divine heroes? English translations are just as heroes. But anyway, I'm not like one of them, Rav Cook says. Hashem Melo Olamim Matsuba Tokam Penima. That their whole world is just found in them, inside them. Yeda ha'olam hashram or lo yeda hakol em echad. And whether the world knows about their inner riches or doesn't, is all the same to them. Eile edrei hatzon ha'achim ashtei raglayim ma yo'ilu em yedu mikvor ish. Those flocks of sheep on two legs, what good will it do them whether they know the height of man? And what harm will it do them if they don't know? So actually for a long time I thought that Rav Cook was calling the mass of common people herds of sheep on two legs. And if he is, then one could understand why this poem wasn't reprinted very much, because that's not the usual picture of Ralph Cook that one has, as someone who called people sheep on two legs. But actually, in preparing for this and reading the poem over a few times, I realised that actually Ralph Cook's not saying that. He's saying, I think, that he's not like one of those spiritual heroes who have great inner riches within them and couldn't care less about what the herds of sheep on two legs think of them. But it's these spiritual heroes who think of people as herds of sheep on two legs. But actually, that's not how Rav Cook thinks of them. And that's part of what's so painful for them, for him. Because he's not able to be indifferent to whether or not people can understand his spiritual world, because, as he goes on, Hineni kashurim ha'olam, I feel connected to the world. Hachayim ha'anashim hinam chadurai. Life and people, they are my friends. Chalakim rabim benishmati imam mishulavim. And their souls are intertwined with my soul. Ubamaze ochalai ram ma'orai kol asher adaber eini ela mechase et zahari. But as much as I want to, express to them my my light, any attempt to express it only covers my vision and dulls my light. So that's my tragedy. Rav Kook says, I'm not able to be careless of what people think of what's going on inside with me. I care about people. I feel connected to them. I want to be able to share what I experience it with them and the insights that I have, and I'm just not able to find the words to do it. Gadol tsa'ari v'gadol machovi. Great is my sorrow and great is my pain. Hoy eli ezra ayeh b'tzareti. God, please help me in my narrowness. Hamtzei li me'argei ha'chei lashon t'nali safa v'niv safatayim. Asafer u'makelot amitei amitei. And he says, "Oh God, my God, be help in my trouble. Find for me the greatness of expression. Grant me language and the gift of utterance. I shall declare before the multitudes my fragments of your truth. Oh my God." So Ralph Cooks is trying to express in poetry the fact that he finds expression of what he really wants to say next to impossible. Very, you agree, very, very poignant and painfully personal poem about how, you know, how isolated he felt in his spiritual insight and vision and his yearning to communicate it to other people and inability to do so. Now, I wonder if we think that he does any better in communicating it in poetry than in prose.
Perhaps a few introductory comments.
Yeah.
I certainly agree with Rabbi Sinclair. Well, I am on his side in saying that I have no expertise, particularly in the notion of poetry, and I have no way of making the judgment of whether he was influenced by one modern Hebrew poet or the other. But the distinction between prose and poetry exists in our sources, although it's not quite clear what the distinction is. For example, we know that Shira is attributed to Shirat HaYam, the song that Bnei Yisrael sang at Yam Suf, and also to the song that Moshe Rabbeinu sang or spoke to Bnei Yisrael at the end of his life. Both of those poems or songs have a graphic representation in the text of the Chumash. It was you notice immediately that this is something other than prose, shira, which might be called poetry. And to the best of our understanding, it represents a high form of faith. Vayaminu v'Hashem uv'Moshe Adon. Moshe Rabbeinu, seeing the future of the world, spoke that future to Bnei Yisrael, so that that if we would say that prose, this of course is simply a way of looking at it and doesn't mean that I'm exhausting the definition in any way, that prose, especially for a person who is guided by halakha, often represents constraints that the halakha or the system makes upon me. It's the words with which I discuss the Torah. And the Torah is about constraints. And while it's not clear from the Rambam says that somehow philosophy is a kind of entry point into the understanding of God, it's not clear to me how the Rambam categorizes religious experience beyond the intellectual assessment of God through philosophy. But if you would say in some arbitrary way that prose is more appropriate for halachic or interpretive discourse of particular texts, and therefore giving you access to the religious experience in a partially, because it's an experience that's controlled by texts, it's controlled by halakha, it's controlled by ideas that you inherit, and all of that produces a control on your understanding of things. And all of that is prose to my mind. Even if you would write it in a way that would look like poetry, it would still be prose. It may be that when Rav Kook turned to poetry, he wanted to write about his relationship to God in an unfettered way. Not having to say, this is a halakha and this is me. Or this is the Agadah and its interpretation, and I sympathize with that. But somehow, after having learned all the things that he learned, to kind of give an unfettered presentation of how he feels at a moment. And clearly this idea that he's unable to fully express himself, which is a notion that's contrary to halakha. Halakha, you're supposed to get to a psak. You're supposed to get to a result. That's the, not everybody can do it, but that's the idea of it. So here the person, Rav Kook, who certainly was a great halachist and wrote at a later time in his life, perhaps, but he had it in him to write tshuvot and to deal with people and to take up problems and to make decisions. And even though he was creative in all those activities, he was dealing with a circumscribed system. There were boundaries that he could not kind of avoid. And so Rav Kook is a man who said, okay, you can sell Eretz Yisrael on Shemitah, but it's a problem. It's not an easy thing. You just can't assume that we know what God wants of us and do it. Or Rav Kook was a person who said that women should not vote, because that's how his understanding of the sources led him, constrained him. But when he spoke about himself facing God, he knew that he wanted to say something, but he didn't exactly have the language that would clearly, whatever he said, he realized it was less than perfect, less than clear, less than, because there were the constraints of halakha, or the constraints of tradition, or they enable you to speak, because you don't have to define everything. You don't have to say everything over again. It's sort of understood somehow because you're depending on a tradition. But if you want to bare your soul and tell everybody something totally new that has never been said before, because it's you, it's not where you come from, or what you want other people to do, or how highly you regard the system, but it's all you and God, then certainly you'll have difficulty expressing that. And the way that poetry helps, again, I'm talking about a particular assessment. I don't mean that I've assessed poetry in any way, but for the halachist, for the person who studies in yeshiva, for the person who learns Gemara, Rashi, and Tosfos, for the person who who decides to write something about himself that has no limits. It's this, not because it's not acceptable or traditionally approved by some board of rabbis, only because it is by its nature free. That's a difficult thing, and it's not surprising that Rav Kook expresses the difficulty that he has in writing poetry on the one hand. On the other hand, it's also true that in our tradition, poetry is the expression, is the way the highest form of human experience facing God is expressed, whether it's Shira Hayam or it's the Shira of Moshe Rabbeinu. But certainly there are other aspects in terms of the formal writing. I mean, Rav Kook didn't write Shirat Hayam. He may have written 19th century Hebrew poetry, but he looked to poetry perhaps because that was where the tradition said you can express, that's the way you can express something which is unbounded and has no limits and is not within a system or a form that enables you on the one hand to express yourself easily and on the other hand to come to specific conclusions. But when it came to his relationship to God, he knew that none of that was possible, and perhaps that's what made him turn to poetry.
That's very interesting. I mean, another way of saying it is that halakhic writing has to be written in a language that anyone can understand. Halakha is binding on everybody, so it has to be, you have to say what you mean in a way that anybody can understand what you mean. You don't have to express what's going on in your innermost soul in a way that anybody can understand. I mean, God knows no obligation to make people understand what's going on inside you. But Rav Kook nevertheless felt that he wanted people to understand. You know, there was something that he felt was important for people to understand, and therefore he struggled to find a way to say it.
Well, I think people want to clarify for themselves where they stand and what they feel. And in order to do that, you have to communicate your feelings. Otherwise, you haven't clarified it for yourself. You're just... Rav Kook probably was not the kind of person who could say, well, you know, I just spaced out, and that's great. But since he was a halakhist, after all, he'd like to know what's happening. He'd like to be able to formulate it, because that's what makes it real. That's what makes it a religious, or like standing before God. You can't just stand before God. You have to know where your left foot is, and where your right foot is, and where your back is, and which way is front, and which way is rear. And you have to know all of those things. Now, while it's true that they're not halakhically determined, but halakha determines what knowing something means. And writing about what you know and speaking it out is the way that we do it. I mean, we have no other agency with which to understand ourselves. And so, it's reasonable that if Rav Kook had this burning fire inside of him, he wanted to know what that fire was about. And in order to do that, he had to try to communicate it. And he used poetry, perhaps, because it was the most reasonable, available medium of expression for this kind of a project, you know, of bearing your soul.
Were any of his poems published in his lifetime?
Good question. No, not as far as I know. I might be wrong about that, but I don't believe so.
Because it's an interesting question. Was he writing the poetry for himself, or for others, or for...
It seems that he was writing it for him than say for himself. I mean,
that's a bigger artistic question. For whom does the artist produce? For whom does the poet write?
Well, he wrote all those.
Yeah, I mean, his poems that appear in his spiritual notebooks, interspersed with the prose, and all of it, poetry and the prose, appears to originally have been for himself. And so he writes, I write, because I can't help writing. I think this touches on issues which we raised at the beginning of our discussions back in May or June. About, we looked there at some passages where Ralph Cook speaks about the importance of the individual exploring the depths of his or her spiritual world and plumbing his or her own unique spirituality, and raised the question, what sort of religious value is that? What good does that do anybody else? Why is that, how does that connect with, our responsibility to our community, say? And he's talking about that in this poem. He's saying, I'm not one of those people, whoever those people are, and I'm not sure who those people are, who could just ignore, the common herd and be happy with their inner world. Now I feel because I care about people, I want to share with them what's going on in my inner world. It's a kind of impulse of generosity there. And there's a sense that comes out of his writings that this self-exploration is not just for oneself, but actually it deeply benefits the community if you can find a way of getting it across to them. I don't know who these Gibbel are. I mean, it just doesn't seem a very Jewish thing to be, to be happy with your own inner spiritual world and be indifferent to the herds of on two legs. I mean, I can't think who he's thinking of there. I can't remember which, whether they were Mekubalim and mystics who took that up. Not to the best of my knowledge.
Or it could be the right wing, which are indifferent to, what you're, this poem is written in
1912 to 1913.
Incidentally,
at the same time as he's producing great halachic works.
Where is he at this time?
He's in Yafo. Yeah.
He's already in Yafo.
Yeah.
So it could be referring to, kind of a cloistered religious mentality that's unconcerned with people outside of its, when he's concerned with trying to create a religious society, which is having a positive social impact on a broader spectrum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it could be.
In terms of the theme of the poem, again, an association that rings in my head is, the well-known passage at the beginning of the Moreh Nebuchim, in the first chelik of the Moreh Nebuchim, chapter 15, the Rambam writes on the pasuk from Sulam Yaakov about the Malachim Olim v'Yordim Ba, that he's puzzled why, and the angels who presumably come from heaven, it should be they first come down the ladder to the earth and then they return to heaven going up, but the pasuk is the opposite, Olim. First they go up and then they come back down. So the Rambam there writes that, here I'll quote, the Rambam writes, how well put is the phrase ascending and then after descending, in which ascent comes before descent. For after the ascent of the and the attaining of certain rungs of the ladder that may be known, comes the descent with whatever decree the prophet has been informed of, with a view to governing and teaching the people of the earth. And here the Rambam is interpreting Malachim to be Nevi'im, or more broadly, I guess, for our purposes, people who are possessors of knowledge and wisdom. So once you've gone up the ladder and attained the spiritual height, like he describes here, once you've gone up the ladder and attained knowledge and understanding, there's a moral obligation to come back down to earth where the flocks of sheep are wandering around aimlessly, to instruct them, to teach them, to govern and teach. Of course, this is, you know, others have already noticed the compare and contrast this to Plato's metaphor of the cave, right? Plato writes in the Republic that, you know, those that leave the cave and see the light of day have an obligation to return to the prisoners that are left in the cave and to enlighten them. And there's similarities and there are differences. In other words, this is what I'm hearing here in this poem. This is the Rambam. Once you've gone up the ladder, you have to go back down. But it's hard to go back down, he's saying. It's hard to go and try to teach that to people, because once you've gone up the ladder, you're no longer like those people. Mm-hmm. You've had a different experience. You've learned a new language. Mm-hmm. And maybe a little bit you've forgotten your old language, and you can't you can no longer talk to the animals, you can no longer communicate with the sheep. And that's a frustration, that's a challenge. Because you want to go right back up the ladder. Once you've been out of the dungeon in the cave, you don't want to go back there.
Right.
And that's frustrating. And he sees, well, you know, I went up that ladder, there were a lot of other spiritual elitists that they have no interest in going back and trying to bring the teachings back down to earth.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to do that, but it's frustrating, it's difficult, it's challenging. Mm-hmm. You need to relearn an old language in order to communicate this. So that's, reading the poem, this is what I'm hearing.
Yeah, I think that...
I'm not saying that Rav Kook, I don't see any textual remazim here that he's referring to that Rambam. Unlike my comment earlier about the last parak in Hilchos Tshuva, but the idea is resonating for me.
Yeah, although he does talk about Olel Eschakim and being Shatar Shamayim, sailing in the heavens. Is, you know, that it could be that also that he had that in mind. But if he wanted to,
he could have worked in the metaphor of a sulam.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be an easy way to, you know, to ring the bell.
Right.
But he doesn't do that. But the idea is the same.
Right.
A Kalbachian note.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean that Kalbach is the only one who ever said it, but he did popularize it.
Mm-hmm.
Our question is, who are the heroes?
Mm-hmm.
Or who are they assumed? Who are those who assume themselves to be heroes?
Mm-hmm.
So I think we could say simply that the people who are the literalists, the people who find it very easy to distinguish themselves from others based on something like adherence to the mitzvahs, you know, very careful study of the Torah, and even exalted notions, they're able to distinguish themselves from people who are not like themselves. But Rav Kook says, in where I am, where the issue is standing before God and your real relationship, the relationship that you find within yourself, well, there are no heroes. Because who knows who is with me? Or who knows who is standing with me? It's quite likely that the people who are with me don't look like those heroes at all, those who think of themselves as being heroes. So I think that while Rav Kook does not disparage the heroes, I mean, he was very much a halachist, but he understood that there were other levels of existence that had to be dealt with or had to be ascribed to, and therefore the people who are one-dimensional, who saw everything in terms of say the Shulchan Aruch, who were certainly right, there was nothing wrong, but they did not soar with the eagles, according to Rav Kook. And further, if you went to soar with the eagles, you could never be sure who you'd find flying alongside of you. And Rav Kook was willing, in different contexts, to admit that there are Jews who are critical to the continuation of Jewish history, who are not, you know, in the same categories, these heroes. And so maybe that was what he was discovering, or what he saw. There's a different kabura wherever he was. I'm not sure that he had names for these other people, but he was confident that just doing whatever it is you do doesn't grant you necessary access into that world in which he is writing poetry.
I think your interpretation of heroes are very convincing. My first thought actually was that the heroes, you know, sound like Nietzscheans. And that in Nietzsche's writings it was the point is to produce great people. And if you produce great people, it doesn't really matter so much what's going on to other people. You should realize the heights which human beings are able to reach. And the great person has to be intent on cultivating his greatness and not care at all what the rest of people are thinking, which was certainly a current idea amongst, you know, secular Zionists. Ralph Cook's time, but you know, who knows who exactly he was referring to. But one way or another, it's a kind of a spiritual elitism, which is not. And doesn't see the fulfillment.
But everybody has this potential. You could never tell who has developed his spiritual potential in standing before God in some way.
Mm-hmm.
It's not an easy call.
Mm-hmm.
Ralph Cook probably knew a lot of people who were very careful about the halakhic requirements of one thing or another, who we did not see as being particularly instructive in spiritual quest.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. You know, like the people who deal with kashrus, like that's a category of people who don't seem to be spiritually fine-tuned. But they do create standards for kashrus that, you know, that are important. I mean, they're not unimportant.
Mm-hmm. Well, Rav Cook himself dealt with kashrus, isn't it?
I think that's why Rav Cook knew about both sides of the fence very well. Because he knew himself. I mean, he thought about himself a lot. And he knew he was different than other people, and if he didn't, there were plenty of other people to tell him that he was different. So I guess he was concerned or interested in knowing what was different about him, himself. Why did he see things somewhat differently than others?
Yeah.
I mean, he loved Eretz Yisrael when he was in Europe, right, when he was a rabbi. He decided that he loved Eretz Yisrael. Now, most people didn't love Eretz Yisrael. I mean, they knew it was there, and it was an option, and maybe they'll go. I wouldn't say they were driven to go to Eretz Yisrael out of some sort of love. But Rav Cook was driven.
Mm-hmm.
So he was different. I'm not sure he was the only one, but he was different than many others.
Yeah. I think what comes out of this poem is that Ralph Cook sees, in this case the poet, but I think equally the artist as well, as someone who has access to realms of experience which are beyond the halakhic, beyond those which are usually expressible, and yet has an urge and perhaps also a responsibility to find ways to express them to enrich other people with his or her vision. And that's what he was trying to do through this poem, and perhaps it's a model for what religious Jews, you know, who have the urge to express things which are otherwise unexpressible through music and art or poetry, you know, how they can also see the value of what they're doing.